Welcome to Launch, where we explore the world of invention and entrepreneurship. I'm Jim DeBetta here with my co-host, Ron Reardon, and of course, our fabulous producer, Lee Cantor. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, guys. How are you, Ron?
I'm doing super fine. How about you?
I'm okay. No coffee for you,
well,
Jim?
I guzzled it down before I got in here, you know, otherwise I won't be able to enjoy it as much as I'd like, but either way. So what's going on, Ron?
Oh, I'm just back from vacation. I was up in the mountains in Gatlinburg and just enjoying the nice weather up there.
Yeah, it's nice.
What do you do up there? Fish?
No, we just did the typical tourist stuff of going shop to shop, you know, looking at the rock shop and also the place where you could pan for jewels. And
if you get any jewels?
No, we just kind of looked at that. We didn't actually pan for anything. We figured that it was they had all these buckets of dirt and the great big sluices, you know, where you could
right.
do the stuff. We figured they already had the buckets of dirt seated with little
right.
jewels, so everybody would be a winner.
I mean, let's face it. If Ron really hit it big, would he be here today?
No,
I don't know.
I don't think so. That's a funny business.
Yeah, I mean, to think about it, I was just telling Ron about that we're going to actually take our kids up this Friday up to Dahlonega to pan for gold.
Oh, right.
And they're, like, I think it's like Indiana Jones kind of adventure, and I'm looking forward to it because it's exciting for them, and hey, maybe
I've never done that. Have you done the Dahlonega?
No.
Because that was a real gold mine place, right?
Yeah, I think it's, when you read about the gold rush, it said it was like the first stop on the trek westward was Dahlonega, so it's got a rich history, and
so there could be some there.
We're gonna dig, maybe pulling some heavy machinery.
Are you gonna bring some in your pocket, like to help the kids out?
Yeah,
you
know? Look what I found. That looks like mommy's. looks like mommy's gold watch. Where's that
it's
from?
My high school ring.
All right, Ron. Look, we obviously never have a shortage of things to talk about, but. Let's start it off here.
Yeah, I ran across a concept recently I wanted to share for everybody that's listening that is getting ready to launch their business. It's kind of an interesting way to approach everything. But they said that when you start a business that you should sit there and map out what you want your business to look like in about 5 years and draw in each block about, you know, client acquisition and back office and things like that. And that you make two copies. And the first copy you laminate, you put where you can see every day because you know that's what you're shooting for, you know, to morph your business into the next 5 years. But what's interesting is that the second copy is a working copy. And in each of the blocks that you've mapped out, you actually put your name in there because when you start your business, you're doing everything. You're chief cook and bottle washer. And then as time goes on, you sit there and replace your name with somebody else's name in each block as you you could come up with some documented, repeatable processes of how you want, you know, the back office to work, you know, with accounts receivable and accounts payable and things like that. I thought that was a really good concept.
I mean, it is, and I think that if more people had something in front of them at their desk each day, they would make more strides to meet those goals.
That's true, because, you know, a lot of the inventors that we work with will say, you know, I've got an idea and I just want somebody to buy my idea. They don't want to do any of the heavy lifting. And I think each inventor needs to realize that when they come up with a concept that they want to move to the marketplace, they're actually starting a business. They're going to be in business, and they really need to map out what that business looks like.
Now, when you guys started, well, Jim, why don't you speak about it? When you started and you had your first product, did you have kind of a five-year vision, or was it kind of like you were just the chaos of the initial business?
Well, I mean, when I started in business, in the consumer products business, I was in my early 20s, so trust me, there was no
five-year plan.
No, there was no
wasn't a five-day plan.
My plan was, you know, what am I doing? I got the weekend coming up, and I know I have to work hard. But you're right, it's it is something that if people can document, and in Ron, whether it's this method or any other method, to have your goals set and say, here's what I want to do this month or this week or a year from now or 5 years from now, it's great to do it, to accomplish it, and to look back on it.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it all depends on whether somebody wants to be satisfied with having a small business or whether they want it to become a really large business.
Right.
Because I know that a lot of the chambers of commerce that I've gone to, people basically, even though they're in business for themselves, it's a job. Okay. And they just want it to stay small and just provide enough income, you know, to feed the family.
Right. And it's interesting also, like, say you are looking to sell 1 million products and you go, well, if I want to sell 1 million at the end of the year, and you break it down by months and weeks, you know what you have to do kind of on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think the key to that, too, is, you know, when inventors first start out, they kind of feel like that they can do everything themselves. And it's not just about business. It's just about the process of inventing. I mean, let's face it, we're not good at everything. Even in my world of how I help inventors, I defer to other experts. I mean, I know my area, but I don't know what Ron does well. I could speak about patents, but certainly I'm not going to delve too deeply.
Right.
I hand off.
And why should you? Because then it just takes you away from what you do well.
Right. And then it's I'm not as credible, because if Ron's a patent agent and that's what he does day in and day out, it only makes sense for me, and it's obviously most beneficial for my clients to send them over to Ron.
To a specialist. Right.
It's like going to the doctor, right? You go to your doctor, and if your doctor feels something's wrong, he'll send you to a heart specialist or orthopedist or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the example that I use with folks is that you're a qualified enough surgeon to remove a splinter from your finger. But, you know, if your appendix needs to come out, you need to get a professional.
Right.
And that's true whether it's, you know, intellectual property, patenting or trademarks, or whether it's marketing or anything else. If you've got expertise in that area, fine. But if you don't, you need to get a professional if you expect to get the professional results.
Right.
Well, what's really wrong about this whole business we're in, Ron, and it's talked about, it's no secret, so we're not revealing anything new here. There's just a lot of distrust in the world of inventing, and I'm not sure if it's because there are some companies that try to do everything on their own, and I don't have a problem with that, but I don't know. I mean, it's something we should talk about.
Well, you know, fear is a reality with inventors, because they believe that, you know, somebody's going to steal their idea, and there's enough urban legend out there to kind of feed that.
Right.
But the reality is that it is extremely rare that anybody steals an idea, because that means that the person that steals it's got to do all the heavy lifting. It's when your product starts selling, that's when you need to be worried. Okay,
that's right. People don't knock off failure, as they say, right?
Oh, that's right. So that's true. I guess that is a kind of an urban myth in the inventor world. They think that someone's going to take just the concept and run with that. But like you guys say, that's less likely because it hasn't been proven yet.
That's right.
So why do the effort of stealing a concept when you could steal something that's already been proven somewhat?
I mean, that's true. And what you see is the knockoffs at retail. So you see an iPod, and then all of a sudden there's 20 other MP3 players.
Right.
Everybody that's smart waits for the success, and then they try to piggyback.
Right.
Because the technology's there. The heavy lifting's been done. And all right. they do is go to a factory overseas or even here and say,
make something similar.
Exactly. Right. And just don't call it that.
Right.
And you're fine. But like Ron was saying, there's definitely a paranoia. But if you're an inventor and you have an idea, first of all, if you don't share the idea with the appropriate people, it's never going to see the light of day. So if you're that scared and the idea just kind of stays in your mind, you're never going to do anything with it or accomplish anything with it.
That's right. And when you look at the four elements of success for an individual inventor, I mean, you have to have that good idea. But then you need to have a really good plan, and you need a great team to help you execute that plan. And, of course, then you need adequate funding.
Right. So the idea is just one of the four.
The idea is just one part of what I would say, you know, is a four-cylinder, you know, fine-tuned engine.
Right.
And I always give credit to people that can consistently come up with ideas. And a lot of people come up with lots of ideas, and I always tell them, listen, let's start with one. Get one idea down, go through the process, go through it correctly, and then when you want to bring other products to market, you'll know what to do and how to do it.
Yeah, because when you look, you know, there is no slush fund out there for inventors with ideas. It doesn't,
right.
doesn't exist.
People well, ask soon me, maybe the government will have a bailout for inventors.
don't hold your breath. But, you know, if you ever go to investors, you know, one of the first things investors look at is your team. It's like, you know, if it's just you and you've not done it before, then good luck in getting any money from an investor. But if they see that you've got a team of people that have got experience, and especially if they've taken something from zero to a couple of million before, and this is, a repeat, then you're a lot more likely to get money from an investor.
So the idea of getting your idea stolen, that's a common mistake. Are there any other common mistakes that inventors make?
Control. Is another one, okay, is that they try to do everything themselves because, I don't know, with inventors it's fear and then it's control. And I wrote a white paper on this several years ago that if you start a business and you're doing everything because of control issues, you don't really want to delegate,
right.
that as your business starts growing and you're running around like a crazy person trying to do everything, you start missing deadlines. And then your quality goes down, okay? And it's kind of like you're going up this mountain of success, and then you just walk straight off a cliff because you try to do everything yourself.
I think the control is rooted in the fact that people just don't want to spend money. I mean, let's face it. I've said to people, if you had $1 million, would you just go out and hire the right people to do the job? And they almost always say yes. So I always know that it is control, but it seems to be fed by the fact that either they don't have the money, and that's okay, or they just don't want to spend the money and they want to do it themselves. But I tell them, look, 9 out of 10 times, you're going to spend more money later because the mistakes you make are going to be costly, and you're going to have somebody come back in and do them all over again.
That's true.
So what do you recommend a person does then?
Well, I think the start is to go back to the whole fear thing. I always tell inventors, and Ron, I know you do too, to have a non-disclosure signed. I mean, they should just get in the habit of having people sign a simple document documenting that it's their idea and it's not to be shared or used for their own purposes. Now, will that hold up if it ever comes to a legal dispute? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but look, if it's an exercise and it makes them feel more comfortable, and it often does, that's a start.
Right.
But just to be worried and to sit home and think that everybody on earth is going to take the idea, I think is it's a little bit too much.
Yeah. And I think another mistake that inventors make is doing things out of sequence, that they'll sit there and say, well, I've got this idea, and I want to file for a trademark. Like, well, wait a second, you know, before you spend the money on that, you know, do you know if this thing is going to sell? And a lot of people will say, well, I've got to go incorporate, you know, and get my website. And still, they still don't know if their product's going to sell.
Right.
Or they might say, well, I've got an idea, and I immediately need to get a patent filed. And these things need to be done, but they need to be done in the right sequence.
Right. And how do you coach a person when they want to go out of order?
Well, especially with something like a trademark, I tell folks, you know, I'm a patent agent. I'm not a trademark attorney or anything. That they can just, you know, if they've got a name, they can look up and see if that name exists at the Patent and Trademark Office. And if it doesn't, they can simply just put a little TM by it. And that doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't cover you throughout the United States, just the territory that you're selling the item in. But they can just have that, you know, TM on there to as they start their business. And once things start selling, then when they've got the funds and the time is right, then they can file for the trademark.
Right.
I think the big answer, Ron, is validate, validate, validate. That's the big thing that people skip, because if I come up with something, it's my baby, so to speak, and I love the product and my wife loves it and my next door neighbor loves it, that's usually good enough for me, right? But that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make.
Yeah, because, you know, your family and your friends and your neighbors don't want to hurt your feelings, and so they'll say, "Yeah, that's a great idea you got. Yeah, I'll buy one." Okay, but that's not the marketplace,
right?
Yeah, and then go ahead and ask them for $20,000 to help you get the product, and then all of a sudden,
then you'll see how much they like it.
But that's a big problem. And when people go out and they have an idea, they get excited, and they should, because look, they see other people making money out there. They go into stores and they see all these products, and they say, "My product's so much better than that one." But what happens is they skip the step of doing market research, of doing consumer surveys, and that's what they should be doing before they spend money
right.
building prototypes or expensive prototypes.
So how would you go about doing market research without a prototype?
Well, I mean, I think the big thing with doing consumer surveys is a picture's worth 1,000 words, as they say. So if you could even make up a handmade prototype or have CAD work or some kind of sketches or drawings done, I mean, usually you can get away with doing something that's not very sophisticated and expensive, mm-hmm. but if there's a way you can show people and then, of course, describe the product, then you can go out and launch a survey online. You could either do it yourself through sites like SurveyMonkey. And
who would you send the survey to?
Well, the survey gets sent to people in a certain demographic. So if you have a baby product, the survey is going to get sent to moms or moms and dads.
So you hire a company to do this?
I mean, yes. There are enough places online that are very reputable that can mm-hmm. do it. Again, like a SurveyMonkey. But are they the most accurate answers? Probably not. But what they do is they allow you to rent their lists.
Right.
So you can. It's pretty easy to go on, set up a survey, and they have sample surveys so you can see how to construct questions. But then you have to pay money to use their list. They launch the survey. It comes back with.
But it's a targeted list. So, like, if you're selling it to moms, it'll go to moms. It won't go to, you know, construction workers.
Right. And they try to narrow it down to the best of their ability. And even though it's not 100% accurate, if 95% of the people come back and say they wouldn't buy this, it's a ridiculous idea or it's too expensive, that gives you some valuable information.
What about, like, if you had a product that was geared toward moms, would it be okay to, like, go to a, maybe you shop at a place that's a mom shop, and you go ask them, hey, can I just have a table here and talk to some of the people?
That's tough. I mean, if it's a local store that you know and it's not a big chain, I'm sure I know it's done and people can do it. And if you know the store owner, hey, why not? But if it's a big chain,
they're not going to.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah, because the key thing is that when you come up with an idea for either a product or a service or a business, you need to go through a series of go, no-go decisions.
Right.
Okay, because once you reach a yellow light or a red light, then it's like, you know, caution or stop.
You got to make a decision.
Right.
I mean, it's risky either way. I mean, I've seen surveys come back where it looked like the product was going to be a home run, and then it doesn't work. And it's because there's a lot of other factors. It's are they prepared to take this product to market, to develop it correctly? Will consumer taste change a year from now if it's a product that's timely or novelty? So, but Ron's right. I mean, it gives you more
information
to process to kind of look at your risk level and say, wow, this is a red. But you know what? I think it can work.
Right.
And if it's green, I should go forward. But until you validate objectively with people that you don't know.
With strangers. That's a key component, right?
Because they usually don't care. I mean, if I don't know you and I'm doing a survey online and I don't like it, I'm just going to say this is ridiculous and I don't care and I'm never going to see you, talk to you, and there's nothing in it for me. That's what you want.
Yeah, and it's really difficult to determine whether or not a product is going to be a big success. There have been some very successful products that the industry experts said this will never sell. I mean, here in Georgia, you know, the Cabbage Patch dolls was one of those. It was a pretty plain-looking doll.
Right.
But the concept that you could actually, the doll had a name and you got a birth certificate, and I think eventually you could send the doll off to camp and stuff like that. My understanding is that guy made over $1 billion, you know, with this ugly doll, but he had a good concept behind it. And a lot of the doll companies turned him down at the beginning.
Right.
Because the doll wasn't a Barbie, you know.
Right.
That's not uncommon. I mean, but again, sometimes we see products that seem like they wouldn't be big successes, but you never know.
That's why you have to take a shot. I mean, that just is the reason to take a shot. It's because even if the biggest experts on the planet think it's not going to work with the doll, you know, a bunch of successful companies turned it down.
Yeah. And the same story was with Rubik's Cube. All the toy companies in the United States turned it down because it violated every single rule of what a successful toy should be. It was complicated and all like that. And it wasn't until one of the owners of a toy company in the United States was in Europe, missed his plane, went into a coffee shop and saw about 50 people playing with the Rubik's Cube over there. And he says, I don't care if it does violate all the rules. People are buying it. That's all that really matters.
That's the number one rule.
Yeah. You know, it all comes down to, in my opinion, great marketing and great packaging, because I've seen great products that I thought for sure would do well, but they're packaged poorly or they're not impulsive. People have to go, if they're walking in a store, if they don't pick it up, they're not going to buy it, right? So they have to be drawn to it, and then to have a great marketing message. And today with the internet, you could take things and spread them all over the place, whereas 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I started in this business, I mean, we didn't have anything. So a product had to do its job on the shelf. We learned old school, but today you could market via the internet.
Right. And it's interesting, like, that when the guy saw all the people with the Rubik's Cube, that was the validation that it had a chance. And then, like you said, Jim, there's so many variables that have to be aligned perfectly to have that home run product. But there's a lot of opportunity, even if it's not a home run. There's plenty of products making doubles and singles and manufacturing runs out there, I'm sure.
I tell people all the time, it's okay to make $50,000 a year or just make a few $100,000 from your invention. You don't have to make millions. It's okay, because most inventors work day jobs. They do everything like we would do, and unless they give up what they're doing completely, then they have to replace their income. But if this is a side job, so to speak, or you're getting into it to get started, there's nothing wrong with making a few bucks.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, Jim's really on target on the packaging. When I was up in central Kentucky, up in Lexington, at the Inventors Group, they showed a video that a fellow has actually started a museum of failed products. I mean, part of what he was talking about was packaging, that, you know, either the name was, you know, really bad, or, you know, the package really didn't draw your eye to it, or the package took up too much space on the shelf. And he was going through product by product, talking about why those particular products failed. And a lot of times it had to do with packaging.
When I was in the binocular business, the only reason, well, I shouldn't say the only reason, but it's definitely the leading reason why we succeeded against all the big names in the binocular business, is because we out-packaged everybody. Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, we were known for that. Like, God, what are these guys going to come up with next? And people got excited. They just wanted to see what we would put on the shelves.
Right.
Instead of just having a binocular in a box, we had them in shapes of pyramids and tubes and, you know, exposed eyepieces so you could actually use them in the package. And people went crazy for that. And they told their friends, and this one told that one. Before you know it, we were this little sleeper company coming up all because of our packaging. So I'm always a huge fan of the product should have to sell itself within seconds for you to pick it up, bring it home, and then tell your friends about it.
Yeah, and when you look at the early success of the Crest Spin toothbrush, the actual packaging had a little hole down at the bottom that says "Try Me," where you could press, put your finger through the hole and push the button that made the little spin brush move.
Uh-huh.
And we all do that. I go into the stores. I touch anything with this, even like the toy section.
Exactly.
It's like "Try Me," push. I'm always pushing. I'm always clicking things. And sometimes I just get lost in the aisle. I'm just pushing 10 things at once to hear all the sounds. But that people love that. It's interactive. Fun, and it makes you get more interested in the product.
Yeah, when I was in Gatlinburg, one of the stores that we went through, of course, had all these chimes with all the little chime.
The wind chimes?
The wind chimes. I sat there going through, bing, 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 bong, 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 bing, bing, bing.
Yeah, that's fun stuff. Ron and Lee, I think the other thing, the big misconception going on, the big worries about inventing, is that people seem to think it happens for free. I mean, I don't care what you've got. I don't care what the product is. It's going to cost some money, whether it's to do a patent search or to do some consumer surveys or to have a package created. There's a lot of little moving parts. And, yes, you can minimize your costs, but at the end of the day, you're going to spend thousands and probably tens of thousands if you plan on taking that product, having it made by a factory, and selling it to retailers.
Now, what is a number? Like, what's a number that an inventor who doesn't know anything, they have an idea, is it $20,000 that they should think about risking for this endeavor? Is it $100,000? Is it $1,000,000?
That's a tough one. I think a lot of it has to do with the complexity of the product. If you have a product that's got moving parts and electrical components, it's obviously going to cost a lot more to develop it. But if you have a...
like a simple mommy product, this protects the shopping cart when I, something that's fairly simple.
I mean, my feeling is that you're probably going to spend $10,000 to $20,000. By the time you have a design engineer go through it, make sure that it can actually work the way you want it to, doing your patent searches, which is obviously very important, doing some marketing surveys to validate that the product is indeed a good product. And there's other little parts and pieces, again, that have to be done. But still, I think the biggest expense comes down to the manufacturing. Factories won't make 10 pieces or 50 pieces. They're going to want minimum. So a lot of that money comes
in. And what's a minimum typically?
Again, usually factories for products, I mean, you're going to see 1,000 or 2,000 pieces. Some factories want 5 and 10, 20,000 pieces. So if your product costs $2 each and they want a 1,000-piece minimum,
do the math,
and then you got to bring it in and
ship it back
costs.
And forth. Right.
But again, it's a business. Like any other business, do you really expect to go into business and not spend money?
But is that a preconception that inventors have, that they just think that I have this idea and then I don't have to spend any more money, that I did the hard part of just having the idea?
That's a very common misconception, is that they think that the idea was the hard part and that there's a money tree out there that people are going to see their idea and then give them money just for the idea.
Right.
I think that's what licensing is about. A lot of people see and hear about licensing, which, of course, is you're leasing your intellectual property to a corporation. So if I come up with a baby product and I go to a big company that manufactures baby products that you can buy in the stores, I say, hey, I got this idea. I'm just going to call up XYZ company, have them buy the idea, so to speak, and let them manufacture it, bear all the cost, and I'll just get a royalty. That does happen, but still there's even cost involved in getting your product, filing for patents, and getting prepared to get a licensing deal.
Yeah, and plus, if you're going to be getting a license agreement, you need to have a licensing professional, represent you in that.
So they become your agent, kind of?
Yes, because unless you have experience or the understanding of how to speak the language of a licensing deal to call up a major corporation and say, I've got a product, I want you to take it, that's not how it works.
Right.
You got to be prepared properly to be considered.
That's right. Because, the last person that needs to be in the room when a license agreement is being worked out is the inventor.
Exactly. Because they are. They're emotionally attached.
Right.
They're seeing things not from necessarily a business perspective, but it is a business. And that is another big misconception. We've said it already. I'll say it again. This is a cutthroat business. I mean, you look at the stores out there. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of products on the shelves. But there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people looking to fill those spaces.
They're vying for the, and there's a finite amount of slots on the wall, so you're trying to battle to get your product on one of those little hooks, right?
Exactly. Think of American Idol. I mean, right. How many people show up for those casting calls, right? Probably hundreds of thousands.
Right.
And how many people actually make it to that Hollywood week? You know, it's like, right. You know, 50 people or right. something. So if inventors look at it that way, they'll understand that it's risky. That's a misconception. People think it's not as risky as it is. You shouldn't be putting up your house or you're blowing through your 401k to bring your invention to market. I think of it as Vegas. If you can't afford to lose that money,
don't do it. Right.
Just, you know, keep thinking of great ideas and don't take the chance. If you're going to potentially ruin yourself financially, I don't see the reason to do it at all.
Yeah, because, you know, we've talked about fear and we've talked about control. And I think one other thing is them to be realistic and to not be greedy. I've seen too many inventors that were just too greedy, especially when they were working on a licensing agreement, mm-hmm. that because they had unrealistic expectations of how much money they could get from a licensing deal, they would blow the deal totally.
Yeah.
They would ask for too high a percentage?
Yeah, they try to get back their entire investment, you know.
Like the first day.
The first year. Right. Yeah, the first second. Right. It's like, okay, I've got $50,000 invested in this, and I want a one-time payment of $50,000, right. and then I want, you know, 50% royalty right. on everything it sells. And the people they're dealing with is like, these people are on drugs, and right. they'll just walk away.
Yeah, I know based on what I've heard from a few licensing experts that upfront payments are very, very rare. I mean, you'd have to have something that people are just fighting over. It's very, very rare. The best you can hope for is to get a royalty and, of course, hope that company sells your products well and pays you. So that's another issue, and we could pick up licensing on another show, but that's the lore of making money, and whenever there's money, people are going to get excited and try to skip the steps. And right. I think that's the big takeaway. You got to follow the steps, mm-hmm. do your patent searches thoroughly, do your validation through marketing right. surveys, understand that you're going to spend money. There's a cost involved.
Right.
You may not make it, but if you got an idea, if you've got some money, it's okay to reach out to professionals. It sounds a little self-serving, but it saves you money in the end.
It saves you money and time, and it can help you know if you're on the right track to begin with. I mean, that's the key. Like you said, what's better? To do things on your own and spend a year going up the wrong tree when an expert could tell you, dude, this is the way you should be doing this. And, you know, you've saved a year plus all that new money that you're going to have to spend on doing it the right way.
Yeah, the example that I use is, you know, launching a new business is a lot like walking through a minefield.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to be walking through a minefield, it's best to be looking for the footprints of the person that went before you, that right. successfully went through that minefield
exactly.
and put your foot exactly in
the same spot.
In the right. same spots. And that's what, you know, engaging professionals and experts in that area can help you get through the minefield.
Mm-hmm. That's right. When I'm sick, I go to the doctor. If I have a legal issue, I call an attorney. I mean, those are the best analogies I can think of. And if people think of that, you know, this business, it's had its knocks, but there's a lot of good people in this business like Ron that have been in the business, that have helped hundreds of people, and it's okay to reach out and spend a few dollars to make sure at the very least you're on the right path and you're getting some advice. I think inventors should get their hands dirty and they should get involved in the process and not just have people do everything for
right.
them.
But most people don't have the resources to delegate everything, right?
But that's true, but again, that's okay, because like me, I learned by doing. But I wish I had somebody there to help me because I
right.
know I spent a lot more money than I should have.
And time.
And the time. And you can't get back time.
Right.
So.
That's true. So this has been a really great discussion on things that not to do.
Exactly.
And I think that's just as valuable knowing what not to do and what tendencies to look at to kind of resist.
Excellent.
But this has been another great episode of Launch with Jim DeBetta, Ron Reardon, Lee Cantor. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right. We will see you next week.
All right, guys.
Super.